Okay. So, today I'm going to talk about dukkha with a little bit of trepidation. It tends to be a little bit of a sometimes heavier subject. And it's not something that is talked a lot about in Zen. But it is certainly relevant to the Buddhist path. It's something that the Theravadan Buddhists will tend to talk about more. And when I was writing this talk on the computer would not accept the word dukkha. It kept changing the D to an S, which is sukha, which means happiness, pleasure, and bliss, the opposite of dukkha. And it made me wonder if the universe was trying to tell me something. So this is from the Access to Insight website. No single English word adequately captures the full depth, range, and subtlety of the crucial Pali term dukkha. Over the years, many translations of the word have been used. Stress, unsatisfactoriness, suffering, etc. Each has its own merits in a given context. There is value in not letting oneself get too particular with any particular translation of the word, since the entire thrust of Buddhist practice is the broadening and deepening of one's understanding of dukkha until its roots are finally exposed and eradicated once and for all. One helpful rule of thumb: as soon as you think you've found the single best translation of that word, think again. For no matter how you describe dukkha, it's always deeper, subtler, and more unsatisfactory than that. And I just added a few more words that are used for dukkha. And it's the sky's the limit, but imperfection, unease, anguish, stress, pain, sorrow, trouble, difficulty, frustration, unhappiness, dis-ease. So, like I say, it really covers quite a range. The derivation of the actual word actually comes from the Sanskrit language. Du is a prefix that is bad or negative. And ka was originally the word for whole, H-O-L-E, particularly the axle hole of a vehicle, like an ox cart. So if we have a bad axle hole for the axle, this will result in a poor fit. This will lead to discomfort. We will get a bumpy ride. How's that for analogy for life? It's a bumpy ride. When I was contemplating a subject for this talk, I was going through a period of dissatisfaction with my life and situation, and at some point I thought to myself, this is dukkha. This feeling of dissatisfaction that I was experiencing, which was accompanied by a mild physical sense of restlessness at the time. And there wasn't any big reason for this dissatisfaction that I was feeling. No deaths, no breakups, no job loss. But it got me thinking about the whole concept of dukkha, how subtle it can be, how deeply it affects my life, and how intertwined it is with existence itself. And as I researched about dukkha, it confirmed my musings about the subtlety, pervasiveness, and strong influence that suffering has on our lives. Let's start with the story of the Buddha and his relationship with dukkha. As you probably all know, the Buddha was born an Indian prince, and he was named Siddhartha before he became the Buddha. Around the time of his birth, an astrologer or seer prophesied that he would either become a great world ruler or a great spiritual teacher. His father, the king, of course, preferred that his son follow in his footsteps and be a world leader. So the story goes that the king wanted to shelter young Siddhartha from the outside world. And he tried to keep him distracted with luxury, music, wonderful food, dancing girls. But despite his idyllic sounding existence, he became really curious about the outside world. And he escaped from the palace one day with his charioteer, Chana. And during his travels, he saw a sick person, an old person and a dead person. And apparently the future Buddha was shocked, humiliated, and disgusted by these three sights. I was quite surprised to hear that, actually. But at the same time, he also realized that just like these people, he too was subject to aging, sickness, and death. This was a strong experience of dukkha for the young prince, as well as a realization of its universal truth. And this experience actually became the spark for him to take up the spiritual path to liberate his own mind and the mind of others from suffering. Likewise, we are all looking for an answer to our distress, our dukkha, just like the Buddha was. It has drawn many of us to practice. The first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. Often it is translated or explained as life is suffering, which has resulted in many people thinking that Buddhism is nihilistic. And this is a quote from Domio Burke. She's a Zen teacher. Sometimes people end up with the impression that the Buddha's teaching was something like this. Generally speaking, life is a terrible experience. The best thing to do is withdraw from life as much as possible, literally and emotionally. Then she goes on to say, sadly, this is a complete misunderstanding of a teaching that is absolutely central to Buddhism, and one that could potentially be a profound source of liberation. Dukkha isn't all bad. Wes Nisker is a meditation teacher in the States and quite a funny guy. He wrote a regular article for the back page of the Inquiring Mind Journal when it was still being published. This is what he says. It may sound strange, but instead of feeling depressed when I reflect on the first noble truth, I often feel relief. I am reminded that life is inherently difficult and filled with suffering, which means that I haven't been singled out for special punishment. We are all in this together. And reflecting on the noble first not only helps depersonalize my own suffering, it also rouses compassion in me for all living beings. In the end, we are all firsts. And as the old saying goes, misery loves company. He goes on to say, the first noble truth can be seen as an antidote to the idealism of the American dream, a balm for those of us who grew up with great expectations. The first noble tells us that our failure to live happily ever after is not our fault, but due to the very conditions of life. In our case, the first noble becomes an agent of mercy. The first noble truth is really a problem statement. There is suffering. We are born into this world with our body and mind, where there is sickness, old age, and death. So there will be suffering. It reminds me of a title of a movie recently, There Will Be Blood. Understanding dukkha is the first task or first step of the path according to the Four Noble Truths. Buddha is credited as saying, I teach two things, dukkha and the end of dukkha. Or you could translate it as suffering and the end of suffering. This is how central a teaching the truth of suffering is. There is something called the three marks of existence, which characterize all of existence and beings. Dukkha is one of these three, along with impermanence, anicca, and selflessness, anatta. These three marks are part and parcel of being alive, of existing. And I think of them as being intertwined because we suffer or experience dukkha because of impermanence. People pass away that we love, relationships end, we age, so we suffer. We think that we have a separate, abiding self that we need to protect from being hurt or rejected or insulted. So we get angry, defensive, depressed, frustrated, and we suffer. We experience dukkha because there is impermanence and no self that inherently exists. But the problem is not that impermanence and selflessness exist, but that we don't truly understand and accept these two things. we get attached to things, people, experiences, and places, and then suffer when these things change or leave or end. As far as no self, we don't generally live from this perspective. We think we exist as separate, independent entities, and because of this, we need to protect ourselves and what we believe belongs to us. Our strong sense of selfhood and ego frequently results in conflicts and problem relationships. In extreme cases, this can lead to war or genocide. I have one of those daily calendars of quotes from the Dalai Lama. Just last weekend, the insight was, there are certain kinds of suffering, such as suffering associated with birth, sickness, old age, and death, that cannot be avoided. The only thing we can do is reduce the fear that they install in us. But there are many other problems in the world, from marital quarrels to the most devastating wars that could be avoided if we only adopted a sane and healthy attitude. The Buddha singled out impermanence when he said, Yad anicham tam dukkham, which means whatever is impermanent is dukkha. This pretty much covers everything that exists. So there's no way of getting around this, folks. In the Theravadan world of categorization, they love lists. It is said that people either tend to see suffering or impermanence or selflessness. I really wanted to be someone who saw selflessness, but I'm definitely someone who tends to see suffering, which is also partly the reason I chose to give a talk on this subject. We can all identify these three marks in our life of suffering, impermanence, and selflessness, but we tend towards seeing or perceiving one in particular. I see, and my go-to is dukkha. I am a dukkhawala, wala being an Indian word for person. I see that I'm most aware of the suffering that is evident in life, more than impermanence and emptiness. It is surely one of the reasons I took up this spiritual path. So there are classically three kinds of dukkha. The first one is dukkha-dukkha. And this is the suffering or blatant suffering that comes from birth, sickness, old age, and death. And this is the one that's most familiar to us. When we break our leg, we have physical pain and we suffer. This is dukkha-dukkha. When we experience the end of a relationship or death of a loved one, we experience grief and sadness. Also, dukkha-dukkha. One of the problems of this kind of suffering is that we tend to add on to the suffering by having aversion to the pain. So I break my leg, and it's painful, which is a kind of suffering, but then I add on to it. I add on to that suffering by having aversion to the pain, wanting it to go away. And similarly with an unpleasant mind state. Say I've just broken up with my long-term partner. I have sadness and grief, but then I add on to that by not liking those negative and unpleasant mind states. This is dukkha-dukkha. When we add on like this to the initial experience of suffering, this is sometimes referred to as the second arrow. The first arrow is initial experience of pain or suffering. But then we shoot the second arrow, which is the mental reaction to it. There is a Buddhist sutra called The Arrow. Here is an excerpt from it. The Blessed One said, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental. Just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one so that he would feel the pains of two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental. And what I was thinking of dukkha-dukkha, what sort of came up for me, I mean, there's a million examples, but I was at Tassajara at a three-month practice period, and I had the misfortune of reacting very badly to some poison oak that I had come into contact with on a hike. So about 10 days later, my legs from the knees down were eventually covered in super itchy, and there were open areas that at one point were draining this disgusting fluid. It was gross and very uncomfortable. And so the discomfort and itching were the first arrow. But then I was really upset that this occurred just before a 9-day session. And that was the longest one of the practice period. And I was really looking forward to it. I think I had a bit of an emotional meltdown one day. And when I wasn't coping very well with the state of my legs and these leaking wounds. So the upset mind states were the second arrow. But when I found that I could focus back on the physical manifestation of my problem, you know, the legs, the wounds, and just look after them and look after myself, that second arrow of unpleasant mind states was more or less removed, or it fell out. And in the end, that very unpleasant experience was actually quite empowering. The second kind of dukkha is called Viparinama dukkha, and it's the dukkha of impermanence or change. And this is when we have a pleasant experience. So it's the opposite of the first kind of dukkha. It's directly tied to impermanence. So we have a pleasant experience and we crave for it to continue. We're watching a beautiful sunset and we don't want it to end. Or we're having a very pleasant experience, and right in the middle of that experience, we can experience dukkha because we know that this will end. If we're aware of this, we might feel a sense of unease or dissatisfaction in the middle of our joy or delight. The third kind of dukkha is sankhara dukkha. And this is the most subtle form of dukkha and the most difficult suffering to be aware of. Sankhara is translated as formations. It is described as a suffering due to the conditioned state. It is not so much of an emotional suffering, but a wise understanding that the impermanent state of phenomena is unsatisfactory. Because all forms of life are changing, impermanent, and without any core or substance. This is the kind of suffering I believe I was experiencing that day when I felt dissatisfied and restless some weeks ago. I guess you could call this existential angst, something that many people experience just from being alive. It is a feeling that things aren't quite right or satisfactory. It may be a feeling of being a little off. It can also be likened to a background buzz. And I've been trying to be more aware of this kind of dukkha because it can be so subtle, but pervasive. And this subtle feeling of discontent, irritation, depression, or whatever it is, can lead to even more suffering precisely because it is hidden from our awareness. This is a rather graphic example of the three kinds of suffering. I found this somewhere when I was researching, but I thought it was a really good way to kind of remember the three kinds of dukkha that I just talked about. So the first one, which is dukkha. Okay, you have a boil that is inflamed, and it comes into contact with an irritant such as salt water. So this is the suffering of suffering. The second, which is the suffering of change, viparama dukkha, is when you have that inflamed boil, but cool water is applied, and a pleasant feeling arises. But then the temporary feeling fades, and the pain of the inflamed boil comes back. This is the suffering of change. And the third one, the sankhara dukkha, is the inflamed boil, which is not in contact with soothing or irritating substances. And it is also said that these three kinds of suffering are related to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences. And the neutral experiences are always the most subtle ones to be aware of. And so, and they often go on unawares. And anything that we are unaware of or unconscious can potentially be a problem or drive our behavior. This is one of the benefits of our practice. We practice being aware of whatever arises in our bodies and minds. The longer we practice, the more we are aware of, and this can help to transform our lives. After I decided on this topic for a talk, I received an email from a site that included an interview with a Tibetan teacher that was entitled Turning Your Pain into Your Path. His name is Lama Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, and he's a teacher in the Bon tradition of Tibet, which was the religious tradition in Tibet before Buddhism came along. When we experience pain or some kind of suffering, we usually react with anxiety, aversion, or suppression, or we run away in some form or another. Our first instinct is usually not to open to it, but our negative reaction just tends to make our suffering worse. Remember that second arrow. Our conditioning plays a significant role in our response to pain or suffering. We are so familiar with our conditioning, our comfort zones, and limited point of view, and we're not comfortable with emptiness or groundlessness. But when we are able to rest in stillness, which is a kind of groundlessness, we are more able to face our pain. And then the pain looks very different and less of a problem. We can learn to practice with experiencing the stability and stillness as well as the pain. Whatever the pain or suffering is, by not suppressing or avoiding it and going directly into it and recognizing it, this can be your path. In Zen, we would say that this is another Dharma gate to enter, the Dharma gate of dukkha. So this was an excerpt from the interview that I had listened to. And the English is a little stilted because English was not his first language, but he's talking about how you would work with this. Let's say I have some problem in my chest or my heart, or heart chakra. I usually don't draw attention to there. I ignore my heart area. I don't bring my connection there. I don't bring my sense of peace. I don't bring my sense of warmth, gratitude, gentleness, sense of being there. My favorite example is just my awareness, just bringing attention there and just illuminating the chakra with my awareness. In that very moment, this awareness has the power to open my heart. Awareness has the power to heal the pain. What we usually do is not bring attention there. The only time we bring attention there is when we are in pain. We say, "Oh, what is this?" Immediately, a very negative kind of look toward your heart, toward that location, toward that chakra. If it happens again, then fear, then anxiety, then getting kind of angry, upset, and then basically at some point even saying, "I hate the pain. I hate my heart chakra. I hate." You don't literally say that, but that's the kind of attitude you have. And when you say hate, you are hating yourself. Nobody likes to be hated. And it makes the pain, the suffering, the sickness worse. So Lama Wangyal then goes on to talk about giving our pain a spacious, luminous, warm hug. And I really like this idea. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And this would be a way we could work with our suffering. In fact, it's a way you could work with anything. So the three things that we can practice when working with suffering. So first, we create space by sitting with good posture and getting in touch with the stillness inside of us. We feel the stillness and the quiet that is both inside and outside of us. This is creating a space. but also creating an openness towards ourself and any pain. Then the awareness, I have a prop. This is the awareness. The awareness is used to look at the pain or suffering that is present. Awareness is likened to a bright spotlight that we can shine on things so we can really see them. Awareness is non-judgmental and shines on everything equally. So now you are looking at your pain or challenge from a place of openness. Sorry, left it on. And then the warm hug means bringing some caring or warmth to this process of looking at and being with your pain. And I think this is probably almost the most important piece, especially for those of us who already meditate, because when we sit, you know, we create stillness and quietness and we're being aware of the breath, the body, the mind. But the idea of this warm hug, of bringing some warmth into the process is, I think, really important. Just as I would be gentle, kind, and present to a good friend in pain, I bring self-compassion to myself when I'm being with my own pain. Because it's so easy to judge or have aversion when we're experiencing something unpleasant. We need to bring softness and warmth to this practice. And this, as I just mentioned, this isn't really different what we do on our Zen practice when we are aware of our posture, our body, our breathing, as well as any thoughts or feelings that arise. We focus on our breathing to get some stability in the mind and come to some stillness. Then we can open up to whatever is happening from a place of spaciousness and peace. Again, I really like the idea of a warm hug, especially when we're experiencing difficulties or pain or some kind of suffering, because our tendency is to be hard on ourselves and have aversion or resistance to unpleasant experiences or situations. And even in our everyday lives, we could remember this practice of spacious, luminous, warm hug. This is being present. This is being open to the world and all it brings, not pushing it away. By being present and aware, we'll find more joy. And the warmth and compassion we bring to ourselves and others is what we and the world are so in need of. To end this dukkha, or at least my talk on it, here is what Norman Fisher says about suffering. And this was taken from a talk he gave at Green Gulch. Buddha spoke of suffering. His whole teaching comes down to suffering, the end of suffering, and the path to ending suffering. But if you think of Buddha's teachings very carefully, as Nagarjuna and other sages did, you can understand that Buddha was not saying that suffering, Buddha was not saying that suffering is not to be eliminated. I think I put an extra knot in there. He was not saying that suffering is to be eliminated, removed like a growth, like you would remove by surgery. He was saying that suffering, when it is appreciated and really understood and fully, radically accepted as it really is, as empty of any real nature of suffering, as a shape of life itself, then suffering is transformed. There is freedom not from suffering, but within it. Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.